Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Is everyone awake and ready?
Awake and ready.
Great. You sound awake and ready. Please pray with me, O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ. Blessed Master. Dearest Mother. Saints and sages of all religions. I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Peace. Bliss. Amen. Time of Guru Purnima Day, which is the honoring of the Guru, and so I think Rebecca and Brianna made this beautiful lay. Isn't that gorgeous? I wanted to put it on Papa and Mataji and Swamiji who are up here. Thinking of our Guru lineage and how Papa and Swamiji and Mataji fit into that, thinking that Mother is our Divine Mother, Master is our Divine Father, Heavenly Father, Sri Yukteswar, our Grandpapa, and so on, Lari Mahashi and Babaji and Jesus. So how does Papa and Mataji and Swamiji, and I thought, well, Papa is our Godfather, and Swamiji and Mataji, our Godmother. So it's wonderful. I think one of the things that occurred in Mother going to Anandashram, and she was of divided mind at the time. She felt so loyal towards her own master, towards her own guru lineage. Was she doing something to betray them by going to see Papa? That at the time Master had left the body, she knew that there is more for her to go through, and she felt God directing her to go to India, to go to Papa. She felt the same God realization in Papa that she did in her own master. But that when that battle went back and forth, and it went back and forth for some time. But she realized that she absolutely needed the help of a fully realized master in order to go through this mystical crucifixion she is about to go through. And she absolutely needed that help. And it's true, she did. She did. It was a tremendous thing that she went through. And so Papa stepped in and played that role, and he never demanded anything from her in that way. Mataji sometimes would get after her, oh, you should accept Papa as your guru. But never, Mother never felt that way. She always felt that Master was her guru. And Papa perhaps had a similar kind of story in the sense that his father was his guru. And he initiated him into Ram Mantra, and he always referred to him as Gurudev, as his guru. But he went to see Ramana Maharshi, and Ramana Maharshi, with one look, just lasted a few seconds, but it penetrated into the depths of his soul. And with that, he went up onto the mountain of Arunachala, and for over 20 days, he chanted Ram Nam straight. And when he came out of that cave, he had the universal vision. He saw God in all parts of creation now, not just feeling it within himself. And so these stories indicate to us that we can get the blessings, we can get the benefits of many saints, but there is one Sat Guru in our life. There is one who puts us on the path and awakens that Christ seed deep within us that will take us all the way to God. And in order for that One, to serve as our Satguru, they themselves need to become established in that divine consciousness. So it's not something that somebody can do just out of reading some books or even having some experiences in God. They must have a degree of self-mastery. They must have risen above the things of this world and immersed themselves into God consciousness and then created a stable state of being in union with God. Otherwise, it is, as Jesus said, the blind leading the blind. Reading from Master's Commentary on the Scriptures from the Second Coming of Christ, Volume 1 from Amrita. Master speaking, we can have many teachers first, but only one guru, and no more teachers afterwards. Teachers call those who come to learn from them students, but a guru calls spiritual aspirant who comes to him a disciple. Jesus himself said, none cometh to the Father but by me. This signifies that human souls are mostly truant children of God, roaming away from him in the wilderness of suffering. Such souls are impelled by the scourge of sorrow to have faint glimpse of their lost home of spiritual blessedness. They begin to long for God and inwardly pray for a way out of the conundrum of life. Then, when strong enough, God is touched and sends help. It is then that the one Father of all sends a superman to earth to give help to the lost seeking souls. Such a man, ordained by God to help the individual in response to deep prayer, is not an ordinary teacher, but a guru, or a vehicle whose body, speech, mind, and spirituality God himself uses to bring the lost souls back to the home of immortality. In the Hindu scriptures, there's an insertion here. An original 1929 edition of Whispers from Eternity, it is written, "As a naughty baby, I cried for my divine mother, and she came to me as my guru. My guru, thou the voice of God, I found thee in response to my soul cries. If all the gods were displeased, and yet thou art pleased, I am safe in the fortress of thy pleasure. And if all the gods protect me by the parapets of their blessings, and yet I receive not thy benedictions, I am an orphan, left to pine spiritually in the ruins of thy displeasure. Together we will fly to his shores, and then we will smash our planes of finitude forever and vanish in our infinite life." This conception of guru and disciple depicts the only real way to retrace the truant soul's footsteps back to God. This guru and disciple relationship is not the enslaving relationship between the blind church or temple members and a priest and a temple or a church elected not by God but by the temple or the church organization or by higher church dignitary honored by Orthodox followers but unknown to God. My guru said to me, "Allow me to discipline you, for freedom of will consists in not doing things according to the dictates of prenatal and postnatal habits or mental whims, but according to the suggestions of wisdom and free choice." He continued, "If you tune in your will with mine, you will find freedom. Formerly my will was guided by habits, but when I tuned in with the God-guided and wisdom-guided will of my guru, I found freedom." This, in a sense, stands the world on its head. We normally think, well, I like to have my freedom, and we certainly have it. God has given it to us. We have freedom of thought. We have freedom of will, inasmuch as we declare it for ourselves. And then what do we choose to do that? Friedrich Nietzsche, a philosopher, once says, "You are free, but what are you free for? What do you use your freedom for? What do you choose to do with your thoughts, your words, your time?" your own individuality. So you see, you're responsible because every moment you are creating. And when you are creating only along the dictates of old past habits, of those things that keep you bound to this world, you get nothing more but being bound. That doesn't give you freedom. But when you tune your mind in to real wisdom, to what are God's thoughts? It was Albert Einstein says that the only thing I'm truly interested in are the thoughts of God. All the rest are just details. And this is absolutely true. When we tune ourselves into God's mind, into what His thoughts are, what is His will, what does He choose? Now you might say, but how can I know that I'm tuning into God's mind, to God's will? It's not easy in the beginning. We're filled with distractions. We're filled with restlessness. And through that restlessness, we do not hear God's voice. This is no small thing, attuning ourselves to God and Guru. We must learn how to still the mind. We must learn how to enter into a quiet space within ourselves, where our own thoughts settle down into a very still state. And at that point, we are then able to hear the voice of God, and it comes as something quite distinct from our own thought process. This is something that we must recognize. Many times people will say, oh, well, this omen or that omen happened, and therefore that was God telling me I should do this or I should do that. That's a very iffy proposition. In almost anything worthwhile that you set forth in doing, you will find oppositional forces at work. And if you take that as God's will telling you not to proceed further, you're never going to accomplish anything. And this is really selling yourself short. And if you have certain fears and you have certain anxieties and you think, well, this is God telling me not to proceed in a certain situation, you're not going to ever break out of the prison that you have an emotional state. This is something that is absolutely essential in understanding what is God's will for you. What is attunement to Guru's will? I was told about a situation where somebody was a disciple through Self-Realization Fellowship, and apparently they have a phone bank in which different nuns will offer advice in Master's name as to what they are doing. And this particular disciple had raised a ruckus because she had come to understand that so many changes were made in Master's words, so many edits were made, that it didn't even hardly resemble what Master had originally written. And so she had questioned that, and she had become known as a troublemaker. And these are in recent times, and so she was in as much as ostracized because she was asking these questions and wasn't accepting the standard answers that were being given. And so she would call in occasionally to this phone number, and she would get a particular nun who was answering, and she learned who the different nuns were. And one time she didn't tell them who her name was, and she went on and talked about a dream that she had, and the nun said, well, I think that's a true name. You see, they're supposed to be attuning themselves to Master, and then through that intuition, they can say what is true or not. And she said, sister, she says, do you know who this is? And she said, no. And she gave her name, and she said, there's an audible gasp on the other end of the phone, and the nun hung up on her. This is not attunement to Master. And it's not as if you can attune yourself to Master without you yourself having earned that ability to tune into the same consciousness, the same God awareness as Master had. This over-focus in this sense of the Guru is not correct. Master says you cannot have Yogananda realization. I killed that fellow a long time ago. You get your own God realization. So how does that work with attunement with Guru? In my own case, I feel the different masters' thoughts upon my own mind. And it doesn't displace my own conscious awareness of myself. There's a lot down through the years around channeling. And in these cases, the individual practically completely disappears. They have no conscious awareness of what's being done with them as they channel another spirit. No true master would ever do this because it weakens the individuality, it weakens their will. And sometimes they'll do things that ordinarily they would never do. There is one such fellow, he went by the name of Seth, who channeled in through Jane Roberts, and he would smoke, and he would swear, and he would do all kinds of things that she ordinarily wouldn't do. Drink alcohol. And these are the signs of a truly, fully realized master? No way. And yet, when you get enthralled with these kinds of things, oh, this is a master, this is person has lots of wisdom, and they're giving it through me, and it's thrilling, and other people get thrilled with it as well. But it's just phenomenon. And there's no guarantee that it be just because somebody has left their body that they're anyway a spiritual master, as if they've gotten all their realization once they leave their body. No guarantee at all. They carry their karma with them. Whatever they were in this lifetime follows right along with them into their astral life or their causal life, or as they merge completely into God. And so it's only here, really, that we can have the Satguru relationship, because it is a living link between ourselves and the infinite. Now, this doesn't mean that you have this intermediary and you have to always go to them, but we have to learn how to attune ourselves to God, because in the beginning we don't know how to do it. We have to learn how to surrender our own will to the wisdom thoughts of a true guru. And when we do that, then we are able to more and more recognize the signature of God. That is the feeling, the vibration, the experience of when it is that God is speaking to us. And we can know it through the qualities that come to us. Whenever we're lifted up into God consciousness, we feel the purity, we feel the peace, we feel the joy, we feel the everythingness of God. What we don't experience is fear, anxiety, anything of a negative kind of quality. That is not the voice of God speaking through us. If you want to start out on an adventure and suddenly you feel afraid and you think, well, maybe God is warning me here. God can warn you, but it doesn't come through fear. It comes through a clear, direct knowingness that this is not the right thing for you. But there are many situations in which we can proceed forward, and even though we feel some anxiousness or fear about it. Now, courage doesn't mean not feeling any fear. Courage means you feel the fear and you still do the right thing. That's what courage is. If you don't feel any fear or anxiousness, there's no courage that's required. And so we go forward with faith. We go forward with a knowing us about ourselves. To really surrender to God and Guru means you really have confidence in yourself, that you know the difference. You know when God is guiding you versus your own mind or some lower force. And so through this attunement, you think on this. Now, in my own case, coming into attunement with each one of the masters of our Guru lineage took some time. In the beginning, when I first came to see Mother, I'd never heard of Paramahansa Yogananda, never read the autobiography of a yogi. After a talk that Mother had given, she mentioned some book that she was recommending, some autobiography, and so I asked somebody who was standing in line as we were waiting to hug Mother, what was that book that Mother mentioned, some autobiography? And they were completely surprised that I had never heard of the autobiography. That person said, that's what brought most of us here. But for me, I had no acquaintance with it. And so I went to the college that I was going to. I ordered the book and waited for it and read it completely through when I got it. And I was absolutely thrilled. But still, Master was just a book, you know, words on a page, a personality that came through it definitely. But it wasn't until later that I really felt like I had an experience with him. There's a difference between reading stories about somebody and then inwardly having an experience with them. The last master that I got connected to was Lari Mahasya. He was the most elusive for me. And I just didn't get a connection. I just didn't feel it. I just didn't get it. And then finally, one day, he came to me. And he came to me in such a powerful way that when he appeared before my inner vision and felt that he was sitting right before me, and when I leaned over to bow, and I didn't expect it, but I felt physically, I felt his feet there. As I bowed at his feet, as I just spontaneously, when you feel this kind of reverence, when you feel this kind of overwhelming awe and joy at the spiritual master being there, I think it's instinctive in all of us that we just want to surrender ourselves in that moment. If you haven't had that experience, then it looks very odd to pronoun yourself down before another individual. But when you've had that experience, it just feels like the greatest moment of joy and surrender that you can possibly have. Mother generally didn't encourage us to do that with her. Fred Kamitz, who used to drive up from Vancouver, Washington every Wednesday, and he would come up and he would pronoun at Mother's feet. And I felt in a way that he did it for all of us, that we were all doing it through him. And Mother would say, I've scolded him, I've asked him not to do this, and still he does it. And she would always laugh when she was saying it. So she wasn't too upset about it. But it was a time generally at Kriya Yoga when we could really pronoun at her feet and just give ourselves completely to her. And it was the greatest privilege that I can think of, is to do that. And I felt that as well with Swami Sat Chidananda. Although he was not my guru, I felt that he was my second spiritual mother. And that I just felt this tremendous sense of God in him, and that he had come to help me to achieve that total union with God that I had not yet achieved. You see, these things, they fulfill your soul all the way through. And many people are scared about this. They hear the horror stories. They have a reluctance to give themselves in this way, and that's completely understandable in a human sense. But when you have that experience, when you see God within the individual, as Mother said, I'm not God, but I have God within me, that's a good description. And yet, that's even inadequate because there's a mysterious aspect of it. Mataji said, you all come here to see Papa, and he laughs and he jokes, and you relate to him as somebody, just another human being. You don't realize who he truly is. And I know what she means when she says this. I had that experience with Mother where, through an inner vision, I saw her in her light body. And I cannot even begin to describe to you the beauty that she conveyed through that light body, and how that light body extended out in every direction as far as the eye could reach. And it was magnificent, and there wasn't any sense that there was any limit to who she was, or how far her soul, her spirit extended. You see, when the individual has unified their consciousness with God consciousness, then they become God in that sense. Now, you have to be very careful in understanding these things. Because it's not, if you only have ego consciousness, then you just think, oh, that person thinks they're God. And it's something that's a put down. And it's not that. You have to begin to merge your mind into God and feel where that mergence happens and how you expand and the purity and the perfectness of that consciousness. And then you begin to understand how the guru has merged their consciousness into God consciousness. And when they come back into human consciousness, unlike devotees who are aspiring up the path, and when they come back into normal consciousness, there's a veil of separation that most times drops down between you and the infinite God. But for that one who has purified their consciousness to that perfect state, there is no separation when they come back into human consciousness. Now they feel that their human consciousness is but an extension of the divine consciousness. And the divine mind operates through them. It thinks through them. It speaks through them. It operates through them on every level. This is a total transformation of the individual from the human to the divine. And when that occurs, then that one is qualified to help others to merge themselves into that divine consciousness. And what I would notice is that when Mother spoke, I would be lifted up into divine realms. I would feel the spiritual power emanating through her, and I would feel it within myself, and there was emergence between the two. And when I, in deep meditation, would merge myself into God, I would feel that identical same vibration, that same feeling. So the God that was within Mother and the God who I worshipped within myself were one and the same. That is the inner guru, that is God within, awakening himself. And then gradually, that experience begins to expand. You have to purify the mind. There's no shortcut around this. You have to go through the ajna here, and to do that, you have to surrender yourself completely. Nothing is left behind. No thought of home, no thought of husband or wife or child or parents can remain with you in any particular attachment. You have to throw it all into the sea, all into the ocean of God. And so when we do this, this inner transformation begins to happen. It doesn't usually happen overnight. There are very few cases, such as Ramana Maharshi, who just had the thought, what would it be like to die? He laid down to experiment with it, and when he got back up, he came back in that fully realized state. It's because he had attained that state in a previous incarnation, and he had chosen to go those 16 years until he did that experiment. And when he came back up, he was fully immersed in that God consciousness, and it never completely left him after that. And he worked, perhaps, to establish himself perfectly in it. But it just happened like that. And with Mother, she had also come with that perfect consciousness. But she took longer, and she went through a different path because she wanted to demonstrate for the world what it was like to follow the Christ, to know what these scriptures really meant, and to know that they were an accurate description of what every individual goes through, whether you are a traditional Christian or whether you're Hindu or Buddhist or whatever. It's universal, you see, but it's a blueprint for what every individual goes through as they go from the human to the divine. This is a fantastic story. It is your story. It is all a humanity story. And we are just beginning to wake up to it. Even though Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, they've all been with us, but generally very little understood. People follow forms. They follow rituals. And they accept that that's the limit. They don't realize that this is all about an inner transformation, that the second birth that you have isn't just going down to the altar and saying, I do, and accepting Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, or going to Mecca and walking around the great rock there, or going to a particular Hindu temple, or being blessed by a priest there, or being dipping yourself into a river. These things are outer representations of what goes on the inside. And unless you go through that inner transformation, it doesn't make any difference how many rituals you go through. You'll still remain in a state of ignorance, of separation. And you can do absolutely nothing in a formality kind of way at all and go through all the inner experiences, all the inner experiences. One of my favorite saints, mystics, poets is Kabir. And I wanted to read to you from just this wonderful, wonderful song that he wrote. And he says, open your eyes of love and see him who pervades this world. I consider it well. And know that this is your own country. When you meet the true guru, he will awaken your heart. He will tell you the secret of love and detachment. And then you will know indeed that he transcends this universe. This world is the city of truth. Its maze of paths enchants the heart. We can reach the goal without crossing the road. Such is the sport unending. Where the ring of manifold joys ever dances about him, there is the sport of eternal bliss. When we know this, then all our receiving and renouncing is over. Thenceforth, the heart of having, or excuse me, the heat of having shall never scorch us more. He is the ultimate rest unbounded. He has spread his form of love throughout all the world. From that ray which is truth, streams of new forms are perpetually springing, and he pervades those forms. All the gardens and groves and bowers are abounding with blossom, and the air breaks forth into ripples of joy. There the swan plays a wonderful game. There the unstruck music eddies around the infinite one. There in the midst of the throne of the unheld is shining. Whereon the great being sits, millions of suns are shamed by the radiance of a single hair of his body. On the harp of the road, what true melodies are being sounded, and its notes pierce the heart. There the eternal fountain is playing its endless life streams of birth and death. They call him emptiness. Who is the truth of truths in whom all truths are stored? There within him creation goes forward, which is beyond all philosophy, for philosophy cannot attain to him. There is an endless world, O my brother, and there is the nameless being of whom naught can be said. Only he knows who has reached that region. It is other than all that is heard and said. No form, no body, no length, no breadth is seen there. How can I tell you that which it is? He comes to the path of the infinite, on whom the grace of the Lord descends. He is freed from births and deaths, who attains to him. Kabir says, it cannot be told by the words of the mouth. It cannot be written on paper. It is like a dumb person who tastes a sweet thing. How shall it be explained? We have to be enticed. We have to have grace descend upon us that begins to awaken us to this path. And when it begins to awaken us and stir in us greatly enough, then we are drawn to the guru. In my own case, I didn't know what a guru was. I had no concept of it. And then I read a book about a man who found his guru, and he described a very emotional meeting. But out of that, I really understood that I needed a teacher. I needed one who knew. I had been reading books, I had been studying a lot of Eastern philosophy, but I felt like I was missing something essential. And when I read that description, I knew that I needed to find a teacher. Some people don't think they need one. Oh, just let me be. I'll find my own way. And they try the hunt and peck way. But I don't see the progress there. I don't see the progress as one when they really dedicate themselves to a spiritual path. Mother put a great deal of emphasis on loyalty. It was something she felt absolutely towards her own master. And when there are so many changes being made to the teachings, after master's passing, she felt absolutely determined to try to keep those original teachings as they were. And she fought with everything that she had in order to keep the teachings pure as Master had given them. It is fine for someone to write their own book, but they shouldn't go about rewriting somebody else's book. Their words are their words. And they should be left alone. But Mother fought for that, but she couldn't make any headway in terms of Master's own words. They were being changed, and there's little that she could do about that. But Master had a greater plan, in the sense that he took her, and he transformed her, and he attuned her to the same God that Master himself was attuning himself to. And then she spoke from that truth. She spoke from her own experience. When she asked me to start giving talks, she said, "Don't just speak philosophy. Speak from your own experience." And up until that point, I had not told anybody my experiences. And so I was shy about doing it, and it took me a while. But as God took this form and began to speak through it, then he chose what things to speak about. And sometimes I think, oh, I'll tell this story about some experience that I had. It never comes out. And other things seem to are by his design to be imprinted upon people's consciousness. So you see, it is all his work. He does everything for the highest good. When we have that complete trust, then we always seek to speak the truth. And when we speak out words, we make them edifying. There was someone who said once that don't speak anything unless it improves upon silence. There are some people who just seem to talk automatically, and they'll start telling story after story. And you wonder sometimes, what is their intent in doing this? What is their purpose? We should have a purpose every time that we speak. It shouldn't be just by rote, and particularly when it comes to gossip. We tell about somebody else's personal lives, something that has nothing to do with the person that we're speaking to. And we just rattle along without any thought for the damage that we might do, for the impressions that we might leave with another person, for how we might damage another person's reputation. What would that person feel like if they knew that their personal lives were being laid out for everyone else to hear? What would they think of that? Would they feel like that? Do we ever consider that? And do we ever consider how our words go out and have an effect on others? One of my favorite stories is of the individual who spoke out some terrible words about somebody else. And then afterwards, they had great remorse for it. So they went to the teacher, and they said, "What can I do now? I spoke these words. I want to take them back. I want to take back the hurt that they caused for another person and to myself." And so the teacher had them write down everything that they had said. And then they were instructed to tear those pieces of paper up into little tiny pieces. And it was a blustery, windy day, and he said, "Now just throw them to the wind." And he threw all those tiny little pieces to the wind, and they scattered everywhere. And he says, "Now go and get each one of these pieces of paper." He said, "What? How can I? They're everywhere. They're down the block. They're to the next block. There's no way I can recover all those pieces." He said, "Even so, those words that left your mouth had a power to them. They've gone out now in a ripple effect. And there's no way for you to gather them back." We need to think upon the words. Do they edify? Do they beautify? Do they uplift? There's a saying that it's all right to talk about other people's faults as long as it causes you pain. The pain of compassion, the pain of understanding. And then if there's something that happens in this world that disturbs us and distresses us, do we pray for that individual? Or do we join in on the gossip and do we add to the negativity and to what's wrong? Does it cause pain in you when you hear about somebody else's faults? And if not, why not? Do you somehow dissociate yourself from them as if you could live a completely life other than theirs? Do we not find in our humanity that we are all joined by the sorrow of living in this delusion. Should that not open your heart? Should that not bleed as compassion from your heart? That if somebody else is living in ignorance, if somebody else is living with the pain that you know will surely accompany them, even if they're making wrong choices, and they seem to do it willingly, that you know that they will have to pay the price. If not now, then later. And knowing what prices we have paid, as we have striven to make that last mile and to go back to God, should that not stir our compassion? And when you feel that it is God's compassion that is bleeding through your heart, does that not draw you closer to God? And when you gossip and talk about others, does it draw you closer to God? You see, everything that we do should be done with the intent that it makes you feel more in union with God, closer to God, fulfilling God's purpose for you in this world. This is a tremendous and sacred privilege that we have in this world. This is what our Guru has come to teach us. This is what all the great saints and masters teach us. One of the things that was very strongly imprinted upon me as I made my way through the causal body is that every thought that we have is a creation, and that we are responsible for every thought, not just every word, but every thought that we have. That's a tremendous thing to come into connection with. And every thought being a creation, you are responsible for that creation and how it goes out. And whether you ever speak it or not, it has its effect upon the world. In fact, thought is more powerful than speech. Jesus said the astounding thing. He said, even if you commit adultery in thought, you have done it indeed. That is a very high standard. A very high standard, and it's just not adultery. It's everything. It's theft. It's meanness of spirit. It's everything that goes on within your own mind, because it is a creation. And when you understand that causal is more powerful and more fundamental to our creative process than any other, then you realize the importance of thought. And what, when you put your mind upon God, do you experience instead? You experience joy, peace, freedom. Why would we ever exchange joy, peace, and freedom for the freedom to have other thoughts but take us in definite other directions? But you see, most people don't want to hear that. They want to think, well, I have my freedom. I can choose to do, and certainly you do. Everyone does. It's God granted. But you pay the price for what you do. You get the results of what you sow. If you sow seeds, that's the crop you're going to get. So really think about that. When you say certain words, when you have certain thoughts, you're going to reap that crop. And you say, well, that's about another person. It's not about me. Nevertheless, you're sowing those seeds within your own mind. And if they are unlovely thoughts, if they are unlovely words, you're going to reap those. And then you're going to rue the day. Why did I ever do that? All I want to do now is to think about God, and I have all of these unlovely thoughts that come to me. I can't believe it. And it's not necessarily because of anything you're doing in that moment as you're trying to put your mind on God. You're just simply meeting everything that you've done as you've done your outward journey from God. So don't take it, if that's the case, where these unlovely thoughts are coming to you, that you're doing something wrong in the moment. Just think, all right, this is the cleaning out of the basement, and it must be done. They've been stored in there for so long. And there's so many closets down there, behind locked doors. And as I do my sadhana, a door unlocks and all these unlovely thoughts just come marching right on out, whether I want them to or not. And it's part of the process. And just see them come right out through the door and put them into the flame. Put them into the burning barrel. Give them back to God. Don't give them a second thought. Just see them passing through right into the flame. And when you do that, you help to purify your consciousness. But if you get caught up in those thoughts, if you start giving power to those thoughts, then you give them new life, new energy. That's absolutely what we don't want to do. So you just simply see them passing through into the flame, into the light, giving them to God. We must be absolutely immaculate within thought, word, and action, in complete attunement to God and Guru. There's nothing that I can think of better than leaving this life and standing in judgment and having God and Guru say, "It is good. It is good. The life that you led, what you did was good." And then if there's more, if there's instruction, if there's things that we didn't do, then we'll have to face that music too. And we make double determination to do it better next time. But why wait until the next time? Why not this time? Mother always held us to the standard of perfection. One of her lovely little plays with me was she had a social gathering one night. It was the first time I'd ever been to a social gathering at her condominium. And she took me into the back and she showed me a dresser that was there. She said this man had come to her and he had been a Nazi during World War II. He committed atrocious crimes while he was doing that. And then after he left, she just noticed these dark spirits, dark energy all around. And so she lit this incense. Instead of normally how an incense just gradually burns down, it burned down within seconds. And it caught her dresser on fire, and there on top of her dresser was a burn mark. And it was years later that she allowed me to repaint all of the furniture, and I have painted over it at that time, but that burn mark was still there at the time. And this is what she did. She would just take on for anybody whatever darkness or negativity that they had. And then she was telling me about her checkbook and that she had made a mistake in her checkbook. And fortunately, it had been a mistake in her favor, so she was all right. She didn't bounce any checks or anything, and that was good. So she told me that little story. That was her setup to me in the play that she's about to enact. So we went out in the group again, and she is there's a devotee there who is taking pictures. And so she said, "I want every one of those pictures to be perfect." So in my mind, I'm just thinking about what Mother had just said about making this mistake in the checkbook, and then she's telling this devotee to be perfect every time. So I stuck my big nose in where it didn't belong. And I said, "Mother," I said, "is it possible for us to do everything that's perfect? It just doesn't, didn't compute with me in that way." And she just read me the riot act in front of God and everybody, that I was being disrespectful and so on, which I didn't know about at the time. And I realized that she was giving me a teaching when she was in the back room. When she was out in the front room, she was giving the teaching that was exactly right for that individual, and I was interfering with it. And she wanted to impress upon that individual to strive for that kind of perfection, you see. That's what he needed to know. Perhaps I needed to have the compassion that not every time will we do something that's absolutely perfect, even if you're God-realized. And so it just rooted me where I was. It reminded me in a way that my father could speak to me in front of everyone and in a very kind of shaming way. The difference was that Mother held me in that light of God and in the love of God, even while she was speaking to me in a very powerful way. And it stuck with me for a long time. It sticks with me now. I can feel it as I talk about it. and it helped to release me from the feelings of shame and awkwardness that I would feel around my father, and so that I could be the receiver of that kind of energy, those kinds of words, and be unmoved by them. She is helping to release me in that way, even though it was very uncomfortable for me at the time, and I didn't like it one little bit. But the lessons continued to resound through time. There are times when Mother would be telling me something, and I'd think, well, that doesn't pertain to me. That's not a problem for me right now. And within weeks later, that exact thing that she'd been telling me about came into my life, and then I remembered her words, and I thought, oh, she was preparing me so that I could get through this test easier. And she knew what was coming, or at least God within her knew. And in so many ways that she helped and gave me something greater. There's a time when I was driving towards service, and I think maybe I was thinking a lot about God and feeling uplifted, but suddenly the car in front of me had come to a complete stop, and I slammed on my brakes. And I was in a van, so I was sitting right up in front, and I was sliding right to the back bumper, and I just knew absolutely I was going to hit that back bumper. And it was as if some film had been spliced, and suddenly I was back another 10 feet, and the car just jumped back. I can't explain it any better than that, and I was still sliding, and I came within inches of the bumper, and I stopped, rather than crashing into the back of the bumper. I just knew, somehow in my consciousness, that was Mother who had done that for me. It was a miracle that happened there. But of all the different things and miraculous things that happened around Mother, to me, the most remarkable miracle, the most powerful miracle, was how I could feel uplifted in God, in her presence. And how, after a time, I was able to attune to that, whether I was in her presence or not. I remember I used to come over from Eastern Washington, drive over when I was living there. And I would work Sunday evenings, but I had Sunday mornings off. So I'd drive over to Seattle about 3.5 hours. And I was driving in just on the other side of Lake Washington, on the eastern side. I would just feel Mother's aura. I would feel her energy as if entering into an energy field. And I would remark on it every time it would happen about the same place. And it was as if her grace just extended out like a large bubble around the city. And I was just entering into that feeling, that Mother zone, if you will. It's a wonderful thing. It's a mysterious thing. And it just continues to unfold because Guru is one with God. And therefore, there's no limit, there's no end to what we can experience with the Guru. Mother's been out of the body for many years, but has been no less alive to me. In my awareness, in my consciousness, it's not that every thought comes from her, but I definitely feel it when her thought is impressed upon me. And when I feel her speaking through me and thinking through me, and it is an act of attunement. I'm fully conscious of who I am, and yet I'm also fully aware that these are her thoughts. These are her words who are coming through my mouth. It happens at times when I'm speaking to you. And I just feel her so powerfully. At other times I feel Master speaking through this form. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. It robs me nothing of the purity of God, for they are the purity of God in a human form. And now no longer just strictly a physical human form, but still in individuality within God. Because God is both universal and individual. God is everything that you are, and more. And to explore that more is the most wonderful thing. That is what the Guru comes to teach us. Who and what you really are in God. So let us not leave ourselves outside of that bubble of grace of the Guru. But rather, seek to enter in to that same slipstream of God. that flows through the Guru. We all have equal access to God. But some are fully conscious of that access and others are fully ignorant of it. By attuning yourself to one who has that completely and fully, you help yourself. You are touched by the power and the grace of the Guru. This is the greatest privilege in my life. And I just want to acknowledge that. I just want to acknowledge the depth of my gratitude and my love for my Guru. I don't even want to imagine my life if I had somehow not met her. It just doesn't even, I don't even want to try to imagine it. And what she did for me, and what she worked to do to help transform this rough stuff that I came to her and I was very rough. But she worked and she worked and she worked inwardly and outwardly to help bring out the best in me, to help bring out God in me. At the workplace for a couple of years, our dress uniform, it was an antique store and we wore these coveralls. So sometimes there was times when I showed up in coveralls and things and Mother didn't exactly approve. It wasn't exactly the way she wanted me to look. The farmer look was not to her liking. And so one time I had to rush from work and I went down to the airport because I think Mother was either coming or going at the airport. And she looked at me in those coveralls and she said, "I never want to see those coveralls ever again." And one time before Kriya, I had a long beard at the time and hair, and she just was reaching up and pushing my beard, "Just trim it up, just a little bit, you know." So the next time I came, I'd not only trimmed the beard, but also my hair was cut as well. Because it was my greatest joy to please her, to please her. And it was my most difficult times when I did not please her. But what joy there is in pleasing God and Guru. And to live our lives in such a way that at the end we might hear those words, "It is good. It is good." O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of
Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet
and surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection
surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with Thy healing
light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
To the light within you.